cut wages to $10 an hour from the present $26, reopen contracts, and surrender your health benefits. These are demands corporations in the auto industry are putting forward in negotiations with unionized workers. This is a new wave of concessionary bargaining that first began in the late 1970s. To discuss concessionary bargaining and options working people have, I'm joined on the phone from Toronto by Sam Gindin. Sam worked for decades on the staff of the Canadian Auto Workers, the CAW, and presently he holds the Parker Chair of Social Justice at York University. Good morning, Sam, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Hi, good to be here.
What key factors created the corporate pressure for concessionary bargaining in the late 1970s?
Well, in the 1970s, it was a response to a general crisis that was emerging in capitalism. I think it's best understood as the corporations had come to the conclusions and the political elite had come to the conclusion that capitalism couldn't any longer both give people security and increasing equality and rising standards of living while maintaining their profits. So one or the other had to go, and obviously they were going to attack workers' wages and conditions.
And you said that was in the 1970s. That's a condition that
Yes.
applies today as well.
Well, that continued since the 1970s, because that was really the birth of neoliberalism. So there was a first wave where workers were being basically pushed to give up things that they had won in the past couple of decades in order to basically maintain most of what they had achieved. The problem since then is that unions and the left have generally been defeated. There hasn't been any kind of emergence of opposition to this. So now it's only getting worse. I mean, one of the lessons to this is that if you don't fight back, things will eventually get worse. And now this is emerging in the auto industry, which is so important because it's such a paradigm for everything that happens. And now we're getting a new wave of much more radical concessions, because now we're really talking about a radical change in people's whole cultural standards, as for example in the Delphi situation, where they're asking people to cut their wages by more than half.
Now, you were working with the CAW, if I'm correct, back when this first wave of concessionary bargaining pressure came down. Uh-huh. How did the union respond to the demand at that time for concessions?
Well, the response was that this wasn't just an attack on workers' living standards, it was also an attack on the institution, because if workers weren't going to be able to fight back, then unions were going to become irrelevant, and this would just obviously worsen everything. So it was fundamental that, first of all, you simply resist this and challenge the logic of this. And then second, in terms of alternatives, we began to emphasize that the issue wasn't whether you controlled workers more, but whether you controlled corporations. So it merged into the fight over free trade as well. And internal to the union, it led to a conflict with the Americans, who we were part of an American union at the time this emerged, and the Americans were making concessions. So it led to an internal conflict, and we eventually broke with the Americans and had to form our own union, so we actually had a base for fighting back.
So the record there of resistance was fairly positive.
It was positive in terms of defending people's standards. It was also positive in the sense that rather than being demoralized, you could actually build. It meant that you got involved, for example, in the free trade fight, and that meant that you were building coalitions with others, because the union was representing jobs and protecting the community, rather than falling into the trap of saying that the problem is workers and workers have to give up things to protect jobs.
Unions fight sometimes together, but often just within their own sphere of unionization. And you've written that there's a vulnerable side when a union succeeds on the one hand in negotiating benefits or resisting concessions that many other workers, benefits they don't enjoy or concessions that they feel compelled to make. Can you explain, let's say, with the question of defending health benefits, how that works?
During the 50s and 60s, workers in the auto industry, who were fairly strong and the economy was growing, began to negotiate health care. In Canada, that led to national health care plans, but not in the United States. So what you ended up with was basically a privatized welfare system in the United States. And when things got worse and the economy slowed down, it became impossible to sustain this in competition, for example, with the Japanese, who were coming in here building new plants, didn't have the older workers, and therefore the higher health care costs. So you've got two kinds of problems. One is that if you negotiate something that others don't have, when it comes under attack, you're very vulnerable, on the one hand because of competition, but you're also vulnerable because you can't have allies. People aren't going to support you if you really have this privileged benefit. So there's a major lesson here, not just for the American workers in terms of the healthcare thing, but also for Canadian workers about the dangers of getting isolated when you're only winning things for yourself. It's one thing to win things and then to try to use that as a leading edge to encourage and inspire others to fight for things. But when you're the only ones winning those things, you become very vulnerable. And the other dimension of that is on the organizing question. The Delphi example in the United States, Delphi was a spin-off from General Motors. So it had General Motors wages and benefits, and then it was spun off and went into the parts industry. Well, in the parts industry in the United States, 80% of the workforce is non-union. So all of a sudden, the Delphi workers were incredibly vulnerable to competition. And this, again, applies to Canada, because although we've got higher rates of unionization, when I came to the union, the auto parts industry had 80% unionization, and now it's getting closer to 40%. So again, it's a question of, if you don't have that kind of solidarity, and if you don't see organizing as building the working class because it really is in your interests, as opposed to just getting more numbers, you're going to get isolated, and you're going to come up against these kinds of problems.
There's an argument that floats around that in the auto industry, the pressure to concede lower wages because of corporations' capacity to shift plants, let's say, to Mexico, that the danger comes from outside, the pressure comes from the competition outside. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, some of it does. I mean, you know, the globalization arguments they obviously have a lot of validity, and we're talking about global corporations who have all these options. But if you look at the structure of the auto industry, not just who owns the companies, but how vehicles are made, 80% of the vehicles that are sold here are actually made here. That includes companies like Toyota, who 2 out of 3 vehicles that they sell here are actually assembled in North America. You've got a regional production. You've got production in Mexico, Canada, and the States is 80% of the vehicles, and then 80% of the components are in that. And the implication of that is that, therefore, you can actually respond by organizing here. They can't just leave. They're tied to the assembly plants that are here. A lot of it is just in time. So you've got the potential to organize, but you'd have to organize across Canada and the U.S. particularly, but also Mexico. And the question is whether unions can actually see that and act on it. And it's completely possible. If you just look at the American strike fund, for example, they have $900 million in their strike fund. It never goes down because the interest on it is always higher than what they spend on strikes. So you could put a few hundred million dollars into organizing, and in Canada as well. There's a question of putting it into organizing and really launching a campaign that says, look, we're going to take on the 10 largest parts companies. They're going to get organized, just a question of when. If there's resistance, there's going to be all kinds of disruptions in the industry. So it's going to get done, and let's get at it. And you can't move because we're going to do it in each of the countries.
One of the other focuses of union activity that you have written about is the importance of negotiating around working time, and you say that that is a way to build stronger class unity. Could you explain that?
Well, there's all kinds of reasons to address working time. I mean, one is simply the solidarity of trying to share the best jobs. It's important just in that sense. It's also important in that if workers are going to be more than just workers and actually have a life, both a personal life, but also develop their skills, understanding, and become politically involved and participate in the community, they need time. And, you know, one of the real crimes here is that if you look at the auto industry over time, over the last couple of decades, productivity has been rising very dramatically. In assembly, it's been about 4.5% a year. But rather than that liberating workers, workers are actually working more hours than they worked in the 50s and 60s in terms of overtime. So it's a question of actually getting control over your time so you can become political and change things. And then the reality is that the auto industry represents one of the few sectors where there are quite decent paying jobs. So it's also a question of sharing the decent jobs.
People talk a lot about militancy when it comes to unions and the absolute importance of that. There's obviously no denying that factor. But what else is necessary for greater success in a struggle against corporate demands for concessions?
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right that militancy is where it starts. If you're not militant, then there's no hope and you're basically giving up. And if people don't see militancy from their own workplace, which is the first place they really actually experience collective action, they give up on broader kinds of collective action. So militancy is absolutely key. The problem is that militancy in itself might not be enough because the corporations have all kinds of power. They can leave. They can stop investing. So the question is, when you come up against those limits, whether the lesson that you learn is we should retreat, we don't have a choice, we better start giving up things, or whether the lesson that you learn is there's something wrong here with the undemocratic power the corporations have. And once we come up against these barriers, what we have to do is challenge those barriers. We have to ask, why do the corporations have this right to just unilaterally leave our communities? And that means raising questions like the question of free trade, which increases their freedom at the expense of our freedom. And it, you know, raises larger questions about controlling the banks and financial capital. So I think the important point here is that workers have to fight, and then it's key, and this is where I think we've had a real problem because of the absence of a strong left, that when you come up against those barriers, you don't just accept the logic of the system, but you actually start raising the question of moving beyond it.
And we began by discussing some of the strengths of the CAW response to the first wave of corporate demands for concessions in the late 70s, and now we have the shutdown of a very productive plant in Ontario by General Motors, and they're getting big subsidies from the government nonetheless. What do workers need to consider in terms of transformation of the union itself in order to continue to be capable of resisting these assaults?
Well, the problem with the response that the union had this time, and I think it reflects an exhaustion after a couple of decades of neoliberalism, and I think of the leadership itself not believing anymore in mobilizing workers, is that the only strategy that there was to try to buy these jobs through offering the corporations incentives. So General Motors gets $450 million, and then after it, it just closes plants anyway. So it didn't work. But meanwhile, the union has sold the argument that the only choice workers have is to try to buy their jobs, rather than insisting that we have rights, that the community has rights. So there's a very dangerous turn in the union away from fighting the corporations and fighting concessions to, in fact, laying the groundwork for concessions. Even though the union actually passed a very strong resolution against concessions, the logic of moving in this direction of corporate subsidies undermines that. I think what unions have to start thinking about is, first of all, I think they have to realize that their members are not just workers, that they have lives in the community, that they care about the environment. And this is very important because it means that alliances aren't just with others. They're actually about other dimensions of workers' lives. And it means that the union itself has to become the center of working class life. And then you begin to build the capacities of unions so that they can deal with this new environment where corporations have so much power and they're not just isolated in their workplaces. But I think that it also requires raising all kinds of ideological questions about capitalism and the limits of capitalism, and not just accepting that you have to operate within capitalism and can't challenge the limits. And this is where I think the question of a left becomes very important, because it's very difficult for unions because of the limits across unions, because unions are so busy fighting with practical problems on a daily basis, to actually inject the longer-run perspective and start developing the capacities to deal with the longer-run perspective. So I think one of our problems is the absence of a left that exists both inside and outside the union.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing these thoughts with us.
Thank you very much, Mordechai.
Bye-bye. Sam Gindin worked at the CAW for many years and now has the Packard Chair in Social Justice at York University. And you can find some of his writing on the website of Socialist Project. The website address is socialistproject.ca.